Side 10, The Boat of a Million Years by Paul Anderson, continuing on page 285. "We could go," she said slowly. "As I told you, we know how much people move about these days, and news leaps across thousands of miles. We have seen foreigners pass by and felt how they wondered about us. Even more do we feel the growing presence of the government. So in the last few decades we have begun making ready, as we did over and over in the past. We have taken care to have no children throughout that time. Our last living ones are long since settled down. We always reared them elsewhere, and believe us dead. We never enlightened them about us." She winced. "That would have hurt too much." "Then the children born to two immortals are themselves mortal," Wanderer whispered. She nodded. He shook his head, in pain of his own. "Well, Hanno and I often speculated about that." "I hate to go," Dushan said heavily. "Go some day we must," Asagao answered. "We knew that from the start. Now, finally, we can fly straight to shelter, companionship, help. The sooner the better." He shifted in his chair. "I still have things to do. Our villagers will miss us, and we will miss them. Always have we lost to death all those we loved. Let us instead remember these as they are today, alive. Let their memory of us fade gently into a legend that nobody else believes." The windows were turning blue with dusk. 2. Corinne Macandal, Mama Lo of the Unity, and known to it as the daughter of its founder, Loras, halted her pacing when Rosa Donneau entered. For a space, the two women stood as if in confrontation. Shades drawn, the Victorian room was murkily lighted. Eyeballs shone brighter than its glass or silver. Silence weighted the air, somehow made heavier by an undertone of traffic on the street outside. After a moment, Rosa said unsurely, "I'm sorry to be this late. I was out for hours. Is this a bad time? Your message on my machine was that I should come right away without calling back." "No, you did well," Corinne told her. "What's the matter? You look all tensed up." "I am. Come." The black woman led the white into the adjoining chamber where nobody dared enter unbidden. She ignored the arcane objects that crowded it and went directly to the coffee table. Rosa turned as usual to face the altar and touched brow, lips, breast. She had spent too many centuries appealing to saints and appeasing demons to be certain that no real power dwelt in things called holy. Corinne picked up a magazine that lay open on the table. She handed it to the other and pointed. "Read that," she ordered. Also here, the light was dim. The journal was one of respectable popular scholarship, like Smithsonian or National Geographic. Corinne indicated an advertisement near the back. Under the heading Longevity Studies stood 4 column inches of text. The format was staid, the words discreet. Most persons who noticed would find them dry, of interest to none except specialists. They leaped at Rosa. "Very long-lived individuals in excellent health, young but prospectively long-lived, are of similar interest. Scientific studies, recollections of history as actually experienced." Her hands began to shake. "Not again," broke from her. Corinne started, recovered, gave her a searching look, but asked merely, "What do you make of it?" Rosa dropped the magazine and stared down at its cover. "Probably nothing," she mumbled. "I mean, just what it says. Somebody wants to, examine and talk with folks who've gotten really old, or who might."
"How old?"
Rosa lifted her glance. "I tell you, it can't have anything to do with us," she shrilled. "There are scientists trying to get a handle on what aging is, you know." Corinne shook her head. "The way this is phrased, somehow it doesn't quite fit that," she said slowly. "And how better might immortals try to get in touch with others like them? It could be a scam or a trap." Desperation chattered. Don't write to that box number, Loras. Don't. We've got too much to lose.
Or to gain.
What are you afraid of? What could happen to us? And our work. Everything we're doing.
Rosa aimed a jerky gesture at the curtained windows. The Unity'll fall apart without us. What'll become of everybody that trusts us?
Corinne's gaze went in the same direction, as if it pierced through to the swamp of horrible decay in which this house stood like an island.
I'm not sure we're doing much of anything any longer.
We are, we are. We're saving some, at least. If we tell anybody what we are, that's the end. Nothing will ever be the same again.
Corinne swung her vision back to Rosa, tautened, and pounced.
You've seen something like this already, haven't you?
No.
The Syrian made fending motions. I mean, well, it escaped you. It's written on you. Neither of us has stayed alive without getting pretty good at body language. Speak, or by God, I will contact this Willock fellow.
Rosa shuddered. Resistance collapsed. She swiped at tears.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, yes, I did. Had almost forgotten it was so long ago. Nothing more came of it, so I thought there was nothing to it.
Till now.
When?
Where?
In the papers, then. I don't remember the date, but it was shortly before the war. World War II, that is.
About 50 years ago.
Maybe exactly 50 years?
Go on.
Well, it was an ad sort of like this. Not just the same, but, well, I wondered.
And you kept silent? You never called it to my attention?
I was scared, Rosa screamed, like I am now.
She stumbled to a chair, sank onto its zebra hide, and wept.
After a little while, Corinne went to her, bent down, laid arms about the bowed shoulders, and cheek close to cheek.
"I understand, Aliat dear," she murmured. "You hadn't been with me but a few short years. You had finally, barely won to something good, something hopeful. After those dreadful centuries, yes, of course you were terrified of any change, and the change here would have been unforeseeable.
Oh, I forgive you.
You may even have been right."
She straightened.
"Still," she said most softly, "that 50-year interval is strong evidence for another immortal, isn't it? He or she wouldn't risk a continuous campaign. The short-lived would be too likely to start wondering. Our kind has time and learns patience."
"How do you know what they're like?" Rosa pleaded. "They could be bad. I told you how I met two men and, well, we didn't get along. If they're still alive, if they're behind this, I wouldn't put anything past them."
Corinne's tone parched. "I gather you made enemies of them. You had better pull yourself together and explain, at long last, what did happen."
She waved a hand. "Not today, as overwrought as you are. And, yes, we must certainly stay cautious. I'll see what I can discover about Mr. Willock before deciding whether to contact him, and how, if I do."
She gentled again. "Meanwhile, don't worry too much, dear. We have resources. I haven't told you in any detail. Secrecy does become a habit, doesn't it? Besides, this kind of thing isn't your métier. But over the years, I've developed my own connections, including a few persons in key official positions."
The voice clanged.
"We won't stay passive.
We're not alone anymore?
Then we've got to claim our share in the world, or else make ready to defend what is ours."
3. The tax examiner ruffled several sheets of paper and frowned across his desk.
"I think we ought to see your client in person," he said. "I believed I mentioned to you Mr. Tomek is vacationing abroad."
Hanno replied with studied edginess.
"I've shown you my power of attorney in this matter."
"Yes, yes. However, naturally you may accompany him, Mr. Levine, if he wants legal counsel at his side.
Why, have you any reason to suspect wrongdoing? I assure you, each detail in each one of his enterprises is in order. Haven't I been able to answer every single question you've put these past 2 hours?"
"We have barely begun, Mr. Levine.
I have never seen so complicated a web of transactions and interlocking arrangements. Go ahead and trace them out. If you turn up anything unlawful, I'll be totally surprised, but I'll be on call.
Hanno drew breath.
Mr. Tomek is an old man. He's earned a long rest and as much pleasure as is possible at his age. I don't think you can make any case for calling him in, and if you try, I intend to protest formally as high up the ladder as necessary.
He left, implied, your superiors won't thank you for that.
Nasty young corporation mercenary, said the examiner's attitude before he sagged a bit and his gray head bent.
Fleetingly, Hanno pitied him. What a hell of a way to have spent the few worthwhile decades nature doled out, harassing people and their business, and always with paper, never with more than a ghost of whatever blood joy stirred in village busybody, religious inquisitor, state secret policeman.
Hanno dismissed the feeling. He's making me waste this afternoon, and yes, doubtless, the dreariness has just started.
He calculated his conciliation.
No offense. You have your duty to do, and you'll find us entirely cooperative. But,
try for a laugh.
I guarantee you won't make wages.
The auditor smiled sourly.
I admit you've given me what we need to conduct a preliminary check. You understand, don't you? We accuse nobody. It would be easy to make honest mistakes in this, cat's cradle. Mr. Termek's staff keeps close track, you know. Now, if you have no further need of me today, perhaps I should leave you to your work.
He ought to be calmer, inside as well as outside, Hanno thought when he left. There was nothing worse to fear than a dismal nuisance, because Charles Termek's affairs were in truth defensible. Every last of the many steps by which a gross income of millions became a taxable income of some hundred thousands was legal. Let IRS try its meanest. Not only governments could use computers, human beings could. And Washington had no state income tax yet. That had been one strong reason among many for moving to Seattle. For that matter, he hadn't really shot the afternoon. Thinking he might, he had made no other commitments. Much of the long summer day remained for him to enjoy. Nevertheless, the session rankled. He knew why. I've been spoiled, he thought. Once this was a free country. Oh, I always knew that couldn't last. That here, too, things were bound to grind back to the norm, masters and serfs, whatever names they go by. And so far we continue happier than most of the world ever was. But damn, modern democracy has the technology to regiment us beyond anything Caesar, Torquemada, Suleiman, or Louis XIV dared dream of. He sighed, standing in the elevator, suppressing the wish for a smoke, although he was alone. Quite apart from the laws that multiplied around him like bacteria, he owed consideration to the lungs of poor, vulnerable mortals. Indeed, he hadn't brought his tax liability down as far as he could have. A man who lived in a country ought to contribute his fair share to its maintenance and defense. Everything else was extortion.
John Wanderer disagrees, Hanno reflected. He speaks of human needs, threatened biosphere, scientific mysteries, and says it's romanticism to suppose private enterprise can cope with them all. No doubt he's right to some extent. But where do you draw the line? Maybe I've been around too long. Maybe it's prejudiced me. But I remember, for example, those glorious public works that government gave to Egypt century after century, and how they benefited the people. Pyramids, statues of Ramses II, grain tribute to Rome, a swan dam. I remember small shops I've closed, men and women thrown out of jobs because the regulations and required record-keeping changed them to losing propositions. He came forth into downtown. A wind, strong and cold, thrust odors of salt water through automobile stench. Sunlight spilled from heaven. Crowds bustled. The street musician fiddled a tune he liked, to judge by his stance and his face. The wind flapped the skirts of a particularly delicious girl, as brave a sight as Old Glory on her staff above one building. The vitality caught at Hanno, blew the darkness out of him. For a minute, practicality lingered.
He must consider seriously, and soon, phasing out Charles Tomek. Death and cremation abroad, widower, childless, assets willed to various individuals and certain foundations. In due course, Tomek's pet lawyer had better move away, drop out of sight. That would be much simpler to arrange. Hundreds or thousands of men in the United States must bear the name Joseph Levine. And the dozen additional identities in four different countries, ranging from magazine publisher to day laborer, yes, they all needed attention. Those which he had created as bolt holes, mere camouflage against a day of need, probably remained safe. Others, though, were for diversification, so he could be active, carry out his undertakings and investments without making any of them unduly noticeable. And by now some of them, such as Tannehill, were becoming so. How long could he keep up the dance? How long did he actually wish to? He well understood that his resentment of the modern state sprang in large part from its erosion of privacy. And privacy, like liberty, was a pretty new and fragile idea. God damn it, he was a seaman. He wanted a deck again under his feet. But for most of the 20th century he had only been able to operate, if he would keep his secret, in offices, by mail and wire and telephone and computer, chasing paper profits, hardly better off except for his yachts, women, feasts, luxuries, travels, and the hunt that was his ultimate purpose in life, hardly better off than that poor publican, his enemy. To what end? Wealth? It was a Phoenician's way to strength. But how much strength would he ever find use for? No amount of money would stave off a nuclear warhead. At best it would buy a refuge for him and his, and the means to start over once the ashes had settled. For that, $1 million or $2 were ample. Meanwhile, why not shut down his businesses in the course of the next 10 or 12 years, then take a holiday for whatever time this civilization hung together? Didn't he deserve it? Did his comrades want that, though? They were so earnest in their different ways, those three. And, of course, any day his renewed search might turn up others. Or anything else might happen. The wind whooped. Suddenly Hanno laughed aloud with it. He ignored the stares he got. Maybe living through history had made him a touch paranoid. Yet he had also learned from it that every hour of freedom was a precious gift, to be savored in fullness and stored away where thieves could not break in and steal. Here half a beautiful afternoon and a whole evening had fallen into his hands. What to do with them? A drink in the revolving bar on the Space Needle? The view of mountains and water was incomparable, and Lord knew when the next clear day would happen along. No, this past interview had driven him too much into himself. He desired companionship. Natalia was still at work, pridefully and wisely declining to let him support her. Dushan and Asagao were afar in Idaho, John Wanderer in the Olympics on one of his backpacking trips. He could drop in to, say, Emmett Watson's for a beer and some oysters and general friendliness. No, the danger of meeting a self-appointed poet was too great. Jokes aside, he didn't feel like chit-chat with somebody he'd never see again. That left a single possibility, and he hadn't visited Giannotti's lab for quite a spell. Nothing spectacular could have happened there, or he'd have been notified, but it was always interesting to get a personal progress report. By the time of that decision, Hanno had reached the lot where he left the Buick registered to Joe Levine. He considered driving straight to his destination. Surely no one had put a tail on him. But accidents could happen, and sometimes did. Immortality made caution a habit. Moreover, he intended to end up with Natalia. Therefore, he bucked through traffic to Levine's place near the International District. It had parking of its own. In the apartment, he opened a concealed safe and exchanged Levine's assorted identification cards for Robert Caldwell's. A taxi brought him to a public garage where Caldwell rented a space. Entering the Mitsubishi that waited, he returned to the streets. He liked this tightly purring machine much better. Damn, it seemed only yesterday that Detroit was making the best cars for their price on earth. His goal was a plain brick building, a converted warehouse, in a light industry section between Green Lake and the university campus. A brass plate on its door read, Rufus Memorial Institute. Those who asked were told that Mr. Rufus had been a friend of Mr. Caldwell, the shipowner who endowed this laboratory for fundamental biological science. That satisfied their curiosity. The work being done interested them much more, emphasizing as it did molecular cytology and the effort to discover what made living beings grow old. It had been a plausible way for Caldwell to dispose of his properties and retire into obscurity. Two magnet identities were more than Hanno could maintain after the government got thoroughly meddlesome. Tomek was pulling in the most money by then, and leaving less of a trail. Besides, this might offer a hope. Director Samuel Giannotti was at his workbench. The staff was small, though choice. Administration was kept to an unfussy minimum, and he continued to be a practicing scientist. When Hanno arrived, he took time to shut down his experiment properly before escorting the founder to his office. It was a book-lined room, as comfortably rumpled-looking as his large, bald-headed self. A swivel chair stood available for each man. Giannotti fetched scotch from a cabinet, ice and soda from a fridge, and mixed mild drinks while Hanno charged his pipe. "I wish you'd give that foul thing up," Giannotti said, settling down. His voice was amicable. The seat creaked to his weight. "Where'd you get it, anyway? From King Tutankhamun?" "Before my time," Hanno drawled. "Do you mind? I know you've quit, but I didn't expect you'd take the Christer attitude of so many ex-smokers. No, in my line of work we get used to stenches." "Good. How's that line go from Chesterton?" "If there is one thing worse than the modern weakening of major morals, it is the modern strengthening of minor morals," quoted Giannotti, who was a devotee. "Or else," later in the same essay, "it is the great peril of our society that all its mechanism may grow more fixed while its spirit grows more fickle. Not that I've often heard you worry about morals or the spirit. I don't worry aloud about the oxygen supply either." "Obviously." "Or the other necessities of survival. It would annoy me less that we're heading into a new puritanical era if the puritanism concerned itself about things that matter." Hanno struck match to tobacco and drew the fire alight. "Well, I worry about you. Okay, your body has recovered from traumas that would have finished off any of us ordinaries, but that doesn't mean your immortality is absolute. A bullet or a swig of cyanide would kill you as easily as me. I'm not at all convinced your cells can stand that kind of chemical insult forever. Pipe smokers don't inhale, and for me cigarettes are faute de mieux." Hanno's brows knotted slightly. "Just the same, do you have any solid scientific reason for what you said?" "No," Giannotti admitted, "not yet." "What are you turning up lately, if anything?" Giannotti sipped from his glass. "We've learned of some very interesting work in Britain, Fairweather at Oxford. It looks as though the rate at which cellular DNA loses methyl groups is correlated with lifespan, at least in the animals that have been studied. Jaime Escobar here is setting up to pursue this line of inquiry further. I myself will re-examine cells of yours from the same viewpoint, the special reference to glycosylation of proteins. On the QT, of course. I'd like fresh material from the four of you, blood, skin, biopsy, sample of muscle tissue, to start new cultures for the purpose." "Anytime you want, Sam. But what does this signify exactly?" "You mean, what might it signify at a guess?" "We know little thus far." "Well, I'll try to sketch it out for you, but I'll have to repeat stuff I've told you before." "That's all right. I am a Simon Pure layman. My basic thought habits were formed early in the Iron Age. Where it comes to science, I can use plenty of repetition." Giannotti leaned forward, caught up in his quest. "The British themselves aren't sure. Maybe the demethylation is due to cumulative damage to the DNA itself. Maybe the methylase enzyme becomes less active in the course of time. Maybe something else. In any event, it may... At the present stage, this is only a suggestion, you understand.
It may result in deterioration of mechanisms that hitherto kept certain other genes from expressing themselves. Maybe those genes become free to produce proteins that have poisoning effects on still other cellular processes.
The checks and balances begin to break down, Hanno said mutedly through a cloud of blue smoke.
Probably true, but that's so vague and general a statement, practically a tautology, as to be useless.
Giannotti sighed. Now don't imagine that we have more than a single piece of the jigsaw puzzle here, if we have that much. And it's a puzzle in three dimensions, or four, or N, with the space not necessarily Euclidean. For instance, your regeneration of parts as complex as teeth implies more than freedom from senescence. It indicates retention of juvenile, even fetal characteristics, not in the gross anatomy, but probably on the molecular level. And that fantastic immune system of yours must tie in somehow, too.
Yeah, Hanno nodded. Aging isn't a single simple thing. It's a whole clutch of different diseases, all with pretty much the same symptoms, like flu or cancer.
Not quite, I think, Giannotti replied. They had been over the same ground more than once, but the Phoenician was right about his need for that. He must have won to a terrifying degree of knowledge about himself, Giannotti sometimes thought. There does appear to be a common factor in the case of every mortal organism with more than a single cell, and maybe the unicellulars too, maybe even the prokaryotes and viruses. If only we can find what it is. Conceivably, this demethylation phenomenon gives us a clue to it. Anyhow, that's my opinion. I concede my grounds are more or less philosophical. Something as biologically fundamental as death ought to be in the very fabric of evolution, virtually from the beginning.
Uh-huh.
Advantage to the species, or, I should say, the line of descent. Get the older generations out of the way, make room for genetic turnover, allow more efficient types to develop. Without death, we'd still be bits of jelly in the sea.
There may be something to that. Giannotti shook his head.
But it can't be the whole story. It doesn't account for humans outliving mice by an order of magnitude, for instance, or species that live indefinitely, like bristlecone pines.
Weariness dragged at his smile.
No, most likely life has adapted itself to the fact, made the best it could of the fact, that sooner or later, one way or another, entropy will ring down the curtain on its wonderful chemical juggling act. Whether your kind represents the next step in evolution, a set of mutations that created a fail-safe system, I can't say.
But you don't think so, do you? Hanno asked.
We don't breed true.
No, you don't, Giannotti said with a barely perceptible wince. However, that may come. Evolution is cut and try. If I may anthropomorphize, he added. Often it's hard not to.
Hanno clicked his tongue. You know, when you say things like that, I have trouble believing you're a believing Catholic.
Separate spheres, Giannotti answered. Ask any competent theologian. And I wish you would, for your own sake, you poor lonely atheist.
Quickly. The point is, the material world and the spirit world are not identical.
And we'll outlive the galaxies, you and I and everybody, he had said once toward dawn when the bottle was low. You may spend 10,000 years or 1,000,000 or 1,000,000,000 in the flesh, but it will hardly mean more then than the 3 days that a premature baby had. Maybe less. The baby died innocent. But this is a fascinating problem, and it does have unlimited potentialities for the whole world if we can solve it. Your existence cannot be a mere stochastic accident.
Hanno didn't argue, though he preferred their everyday banter or straightforward talk about the work. He had found after years of acquaintance that here was one of the rare people whom he could trust with his secret, and in this case it might, just possibly, bring an end to the need for secrecy. If Sam Giannotti could endure knowing of lives that went on for millennia, and keep silent about them even with his wife, because of a faith whose elements Hanno remembered as having been ancient in Hiram's Tyre, so be it.
But never mind, the scientist went on. What I wish more, right now and always, is the same as ever. That you'd release me from my promise and let me make known, or better, make known yourself, what you are.
Sorry, Hanno said. Must I repeat why not?
Cast off that suspiciousness, can't you? I forget how many times I've told you the Middle Ages are behind us. Nobody will burn you for a witch. Show the world the proofs you showed me.
I've learned to be leery of doing anything irrevocable.
Will I never make you understand? I'm shackled. I can't so much as tell my staff the truth. We piddle around and...
If you come out of the closet, Bob, discovering the immortality mechanism will become the human race's top priority. Every resource will go to it. The knowledge that it is possible is half the battle, I swear. They might crack it inside of 10 years. Meanwhile, can't you see the dying down of war, arms races, terrorism, despotism, given such a prospect before everyone? How many needless deaths can you stand to have on your conscience?
And I've told you before. I doubt the outcome would be anything like that sweet, Hanno snapped. 3,000 years of experience as close as makes no difference, say otherwise. An overnight revelation like that would upset too many apple carts.
He had no cause to repeat how he controlled the veto. If and when necessary, he would dispose of the things he had used to convince Giannotti. John Wanderer, Dushan, and Asagao were accustomed to following his lead. He far and away their senior. Should one of them rebel and reveal, that person possessed no evidence of the kind that Hanno had assembled. After 40 or 50 years of observation, people might take the claim seriously. But why would an immortal spend so great a while in custody? Richelieu had been right. 3.5 centuries ago, the risks were too large. If your body stayed youthful, you kept a young animal's strong desire to live.
Giannotti sank back into his chair.
Oh, hell, let's not rehash a stale argument, he muttered. Louder. I do ask you to put that pessimism and cynicism of yours aside and think again. When everybody can have your lifespan, you'll have no more reason to hide.
Sure, Hanno agreed.
Why do you suppose I founded this place? But let the change come gradually, with forewarning. Give me and my friends and the world time to prepare. Meanwhile, you said it, the argument has long since gone moldy.
Giannotti laughed as a man may laugh when he can lower a burden from his shoulders.
Okay, shop talk and gossip. What's new with you?
Time goes fast in congenial company. The hour was past 6 when Hanno pulled up in front of Caldwell's house. The unpretentious building on Queen Anne Hill had a magnificent view. He stood for a minute and savored it. Beneath a westering sun, the distant mountains seemed to glimmer only half-real, as if they rose in a dream or in elf-land. Southward, beyond the slim silhouette of the Space Needle, the light turned Elliott Bay to molten silver and touched treetops with gold. Farther on were near bulwarked heaven, blue rock mass, and white purity. Air went cool into breath. Traffic noises were a whisper, and a robin loosed scraps of melody. Yes, he thought, this was a lovely planet, an Aladdin's hoard of wonders. Too bad how humans mucked it up. Nevertheless, he intended to stick around. A bit reluctantly, he went inside. Natalia Thurlow was there, and the door not locked. She sat before the television watching the news. A jowly face and beaky nose filled the screen. The voice was lubricated, sonorous. "Join in your noble cause. It is the cause of men and women of good will everywhere. The squandering of untold wealth on weapons of mass destruction, while human beings go hungry and homeless, must end, and end soon. I pledge myself..." The view panned back to show a packed auditorium. On the stage, American and Soviet flags flanked Edmund Moriarty. The United Nations banner was spread directly behind, and a streamer above read, "Concerned Citizens Committee for Peace."
"Judas Priest," Hanno groaned. "Do you want me to barf on our nice new carpet?" Natalia turned the set off and came to give him a hug and a kiss. He responded energetically. She was a rangy blonde in her mid-30s who knew well how to please him, not least by being an independent sort. Having disengaged, she ran fingers through the hair he had rumpled. "Hey, big boy, you came out of that bad mood in a hurry," she laughed. "Not quite so fast, if you please. Dinner won't wait for more than a short drink. I expected you earlier." Usually she cooked. Hannah was good at it, but she found it relaxing after a day of working on computer software. She cocked her head. "Of course, afterward." "Well, all I want is a beer," he said. "Sam and I hoisted a couple at the lab." "What? I thought you had less fun in Prospect." "So did I, but I got out of the internal reaming service sooner than I feared." He had mentioned he was in for such a session, though not the identities actually involved. He sought the kitchen. She had already poured herself a sherry. Returning with his mug of Ballard Bitter to sit down on the couch beside her, he found she had gone serious, half angry. "Bob," she said, "I insist you quit making nasty cracks about the government. Sure, it has its faults, including heavy-handedness, but it is ours. Government of the people, by the people, and for the people." "Yeah, trouble is, the three classes of people aren't the same. I've heard you on the subject before, in case you've forgotten. If you're right about that being the nature of government, why bitch at this one? It is the only thing that stands between us and what is far worse. Not if Senator Moriarty has his way." "Wait a minute," she said sharply. "You're entitled to call him mistaken, but not to call him a traitor, the way I've heard you imply. He speaks for millions of perfectly decent Americans." "So they imagine. His real constituency is industries that vote their tariff protections and subsidies, bums who vote their handouts, and intellectuals who vote their slogans. As for this newfound pacifism of his, that's the current fashion. Before, his breed was always hell-bent to get us into foreign wars, except that we mustn't win any that were fought against communists. Now he's picking up extra votes. Someday they may help him into the White House, by telling us that violence never settles anything. If only the city fathers of Carthage could talk to him." She put irritation aside and riposted with a grin. "Plagiarizing Heinlein, are you?" He had come to admire the deftness with which she could diffuse a quarrel. They'd had too many lately. Chuckling, he relaxed. "You're right. I am a fool to waste good drinking time on politics, especially when it's in the company of a sexy woman." Inwardly, there passed through him, "He may have delivered himself into my hands, though. I'll get a tape of the proceedings tomorrow. If they went as I imagine, well, the next issue of the Chart Room is almost ready to go to press. I barely have time to pull Tannehill's editorial and slip in another that'll be pure schadenfreude to write." Natalia laid a hand over his. "You're pretty sexy yourself, for your information," she said. "Horrible old reactionary. But if word got around about what you're like in bed, I'd have to fight the women off with a shillelagh." Her smile faded. She sat quiet a while before adding softly, "No, I take that first part back. I think you're down on governments because you've seen victims of their blunders and, yes, cruelties. It would be better if you were in charge. Under that crusty exterior, you're fine and considerate." "And too smart to want power," he interpolated. "And you are not old, either," she went on. "Not in any way that counts." 67 last time I looked. At Robert Caldwell's birth certificate. "I could be your father or your grandfather if my son and I had been a tad precocious. I could be your hundredfold great-grandfather. Quite possibly I am." He felt her gaze on him, but didn't meet it. "When I look, I see a person who appears younger than me. It's eerie." "Persistent ancestors, I've told you." A bottle of hair dye, to pretend indulgence of that small vanity. I've also told you you should start shopping for a newer model. I honestly don't want it to get too late for you.
We'll see. A single time in their 3-year union had she suggested marriage. Were he using a different, younger personality, he might well have gone through with it. As was, he couldn't explain what a dirty trick on her it would be. The thought flitted through him that if he did make known what he was, and Giannotti's estimate of the rate of progress thereafter proved right, Natalia could become immortal herself, probably rejuvenated, too. Given such a command of biochemistry, that ought to be easy. But while he was fond of her, he had not permitted himself to fall really in love for centuries, and he didn't feel ready to unleash incalculable consequences on the world. Not this evening, at least. She put on gaiety. "Who's your Danish pen pal?" He blinked. "What?" "In today's mail. Otherwise nothing special." "Hey, important, is it?" His heart thudded. "I'll see. Excuse me a minute." He'd not thought about the post. It lay on a corner table. As he took the envelope postmarked Copenhagen, he saw the printed name and address of a hotel and handwritten above it, Helmut Becker. His agent in Frankfurt, receiving responses to an advertisement published throughout Northern Europe, then following up on any that seemed to come from a person who might fit his requirements. Of course, Becker had merely been told that the Rufus Lab wanted to contact members of long-lived families if they were young but showed intelligence, as evinced by an interest in history. That was ideal. Hanno forced his mouth and hands into steadiness. He opened the letter. It was in stilted English, but there was no reason Natalia shouldn't read it. She knew about the project, considered the approach unscientific, but tolerated it together with the rest of his eccentricities. In fact, he should give her every appearance of openness to hide the excitement that roared within him. "Apparently I've got a little trip ahead of me," he told her. 4. They were friendly folks in the Lost River Country, and besides, Chinese farmers had always done well throughout Idaho. So when Mr. and Mrs. Du became tenants of the property that Tomek Enterprises owned, neighbors made them welcome. Their background was interesting to hear about. He a small landowner in Taiwan, she the daughter of a Japanese trade representative there. Marriages like that faced problems in Asia, even this long after the war. Also, they had some difficulties with the Kuomintang government. Nothing terrible, but enough to make them feel restricted and harassed. Through her family, they met Mr. Tomek himself, who arranged for them to come to America. At first their English was broken, but they soon became pretty good at it. Still, they never quite fitted in. They managed the fields and herds well. They kept the house spick and span, and if some things in it were kind of odd, you had to expect that. They were well-behaved, polite, helpful. However, they held themselves back, joined no church or social club or anything, got along in company but didn't really open up, repaid invitations with fine food and pleasant conversation, but took no lead in sociability. Well, they were Orientals, and maybe that made them feel sensitive about having had no children. After 6 years, they did stir gossip and uneasiness. They'd gone off on vacations from time to time, like most people, except that they said practically nothing about where it was to or what they'd done. Now they came back with a pair of youngsters from Chicago, slum kids, been in trouble, one of them black. It wasn't an adoption, the Dews explained. They simply aimed to see what a real home in a healthy environment could do. They had letters to show this was okay with the authorities. Their neighbors worried about mischief, misleading of their own children, maybe drugs. Edith Harmon, who was a forceful lady, took it upon herself to call when Sean was away and have a heart-to-heart talk with Asagao. "I understand your feelings, dear, and it's kind of you, but we have so much do-gooding these days." Asagao smiled and asked, "Is do-badding better?" She went on at once. "I promise you it will be all right. My husband and I have guided lives before now." "Really? It gives meaning to ours, or perhaps you have heard about the Buddhist concept of acquiring merit. Here, let me warm that coffee for you. And it did succeed. There was a little friction at first, especially in school. The boy got into a couple of fights. The girl was caught shoplifting. Their fosterers straightened them out fast and thoroughly. Sean might not be the smartest man alive, but he was no dummy either, and he had a way of getting others to do what he wanted that did not come just from great physical strength. Asagao was quiet, gentle, and, the neighborhood discovered, sharp as a tack. The kids worked hard on the ranch and soon worked hard in school. They became popular. After 4 years they left, of an age, and qualified to take jobs waiting for them elsewhere. Folks missed them and didn't object to the new waifs who then arrived. Instead, the community felt proud. The dues didn't go looking for children. They told how they had been appalled at what they read or saw on TV, afterward witnessed for themselves. Inquiring around, they came on an outfit, small but with branches in several big cities, that tried to make placements. Mutual trust developed. The original experience showed what they had to offer and what sort of kids would likely benefit from it. After that, the organization chose and sent. Sean and Asagao figured three at a time was as much as they could rightly handle, and not if those all came at once. So 2 years had passed when they got the third member of the second group. She was a 14-year-old from New York. They met her at the Pocatello Airport and drove her back to their place. To start with, Juanita was a handful and a half, nervous as a trapped bobcat, often sullen, sometimes exploding in screams and curses that shocked the ranch hands. They had learned patience and firmness, though. The youngsters already there had gotten to a point where they, too, were a steadying, calming force. Above all, the married couple was, and also the beautiful land. Open air, honest labor, hearty food. It helped that this was summer. Juanita didn't have school to cope with as well. Soon she was turning into quite the little lady. One day Asagao asked her to come along, the two of them alone, and help pick berries in a hidden nook of the hills, more than an hour away on horseback. They packed a lunch and took their time. On the way home, shy young dreams began to reach lips. Asagao well knew how to keep talk aflow without pushing. Yesterday a thunderstorm had broken a hot spell. The air was full of wayward breezes and soft smells. Light was lengthening from the west, but still held that upland brilliance which made the mountains seem almost next door, and yet left you feeling what a vastness you looked across. Clouds towered white into dizzying depths of blue. The valley rolled in a thousand shades of green, twinkly with irrigation, on and on toward the orchards and ranch buildings. Red-winged blackbirds darted and cried over the pasture, and cattle near the fence line lifted large eyes to watch the horses pass. Leather squeaked, hoofs plopped. Riding was oneness in a lazy, sweet rhythm. "I really would like to learn about your religion, Mrs. Dew," Juanita said. She was a dark, thin girl who walked with a limp. Her father used to beat her, as he did her mother, till at last she put a kitchen knife in his shoulder and ran off. In the saddle she was on her way to centaurhood, and corrective surgery was scheduled for later this year. Meanwhile she did her share of chores, assigned to allow for the handicap. "It must be wonderful if—" She flushed, glanced aside, dropped her voice. "If it's got believers like you and Mr. Dew." Asagao smiled. "Thank you, love, though we are quite ordinary, you know. I think you had better get back into your own church. Of course, we'll be glad to explain what we can. All our children have been interested. But what we live by can't actually be put in words. It's very alien to this country. It might not even be a religion by your standards, but more a way of life, of trying to get in harmony with the universe." Juanita gave her a quick, searching regard. "Like the unity?"
"The what?"
"The unity, where I come from, except they couldn't take me. I asked a guy who belongs, but he said it's a lifeboat as full as it can carry." A sigh. "Then I got lucky and got found by, for you. I think probably this is better. You'll fix me to go live any place. The unity, you stay with it.
I think. But I don't know much about it. They don't talk, the members. Your friend must have, if you heard about it. Oh, word gets around. The dope dealers, now they hate it. But I guess it's only in the New York area. And like I said, the higher you go in it, the less you tell. Manuel, he's too young. He grew up in it. His parents did, too, but they say he's not ready yet. He doesn't know much except about the housing and education and, well, members help each other.
That sounds good. I have heard of such organizations.
Oh, this isn't a co-op exactly, and it's not like, the Guardian Angels, except for what they call sentinel stands, and it's sort of like a church, except not that either. Members can believe anything they want, but they do have services, retreats. That's how come I wondered if this was like the Unity.
No, can't be. We're simply a family. We wouldn't have any idea how to run anything larger.
I guess that's why the Unity stopped growing, Juanita said thoughtfully. Mama Lo can only keep track of so much.
Mama Lo? The name I've heard. She's kind of a high priestess. Except it isn't a church, but they say she's real powerful. They do what she wants in the Unity.
How long has this been going on?
I don't know. A long time. I heard the first Mama Lo was the mother of this one, or was she the grandmother?
A black woman, though I hear she's got a white woman works close with her. Always has had.
This is fascinating, Asagao said. Do go on.
Evenings after dinner were usually for being together. Foster parents and children talked, played games, sat quietly reading. Sometimes they watched the single television set, but only by mutual consent, subject to adult overrule. A person who wished to be alone could withdraw to his or her room with a book or pursue a hobby in the little workshop. Thus the hour was late when Dushan and Asagao walked out. They ranged widely and were gone long. Nevertheless, they spoke in Chinese. To be sure, their dialect of it still came most easily to them of the tongues they had mutually mastered in their centuries. Night lay cool and still. Land reached shadowy. Treetops loomed darkling beneath the extravagant stars of the high west. Once an owl hooted repeatedly before ghosting past.
"They could so well be our kind," Asagao's tone shivered. Something built up slowly over generations, yet centered on one or two individuals who talk about being mother and child, but remain mysterious and work in the same style. We two were chiefs under one title or another of different villages. Our businesses in the cities were incidental. Hanno made his businesses into his power, protection, and disguise. Here may be a third way. Down among the poor, the rootless, the disinherited. Give them leadership, counsel, purpose, hope. In return, they will provide you your little kingdom or queendom, and there you can live safe, hidden for mortal lifetimes.
It may be, Dushan replied in the slow fashion that was his when he thought hard. Or perhaps not.
We will write to Hanno. He will investigate.
Or should we do that?
What?
He checked his stride, startled.
He knows how. We are country folk, you and I.
Will he not keep these immortals underground, as he has kept Wanderer and us, as he would keep that Turk, did the man not stay aside on his own account?
Well, he has explained why.
How sure are we that he is right? Asagao demanded. You know how I have studied. I have talked with that learned man, Giannotti, whenever he examined us again. Do we truly need to go on beneath our masks? It was not always necessary for us in Asia. It never was for Wanderer among his wild Indians. Is it in America today? Times have changed. If we made ourselves known, it could well mean immortality for everyone within a few years.
Maybe it would not. And what then would people do to us?
I know, and yet why must we take it for granted that Hanno is right? Why shouldn't we decide for ourselves whether he is the wisest because he is the oldest,
or else has grown set in his ways and now is making a horrible mistake out of needless fear and utter selfishness. At worst, we die. Asagao lifted her head against the stars. We die like everybody else, except that we have had so many, many years. I am not afraid to. Are you? No. Dushan laughed a bit. I dislike the thought. Yes, I admit that. Sobering. We do have to tell him about this unity thing. He has the means, the knowledge, to find out. We don't. Asagao nodded. True. After a moment. But once we have learned whether or not these are like us, we owe Hanno much. Entry to this nation through Tomek's influence over a certain congressman. Help in getting acquainted with it. Establishment here, once they realized that American cities would never be for them. We do. We also owe humanity much, I think, and ourselves. Freedom to choose is our right, too. Let us see what happens, Dushan proposed. They walked on a while in silence. A bright, rapid star rose in the west and crossed the lower constellations. Look, Dushan said, a satellite. This is an age of marvels. I believe that is Mir, she answered slowly. What? Oh, yes, the Russian one. The space station, the only space station, and the United States since Challenger. Asagao had no further need to speak. As long as they had lived together, they could each often follow what was in the other's mind. Dynasties flourish and fall. Empires do. Nations. Peoples. Destinies. 5. And may holiness be with your good angels. Let the fire burn strong and the rainbow bear peace. Go now toward God. Fare you well. Rosa Deneau raised her hands in benediction, brought them over her bosom, and bowed to the cross that stood on the altar before her between the red and the black candles in their lily-shaped holders. Opposite, her fellow celebrants did likewise. They were a score, male and female, mostly dark of skin and gray of hair, elders of the families that would be living here. The service had lasted an hour. Simple words, chants to a drumbeat, a sacred dance, hypnotic in its very restraint and softness. The gathering departed without speaking, though several threw her wide smiles, and a number signed themselves. She remained for a time, sought a chair and a deeper calm. As yet the chapel was sparsely furnished. Behind the altar hung a picture of Jesus, more gaunt and stern than was common, although his hand was upraised in blessing. Painted directly on plaster, the serpent of life encircled him. It was flanked by emblems that could be of the Loas or the saints, however you wished. The symbols right and left could be luck, magic, sanctity, or just encouragement, she knew. Lift up your heart, honor with bravery the life that is in you. Here was no doctrine, but the sacredness of creation because of the Creator's presence in it. No commandment but loyalty to your kindred of the spirit. The animistic, pantheistic imagery was only a language for saying that. The rites were only to evoke it and to bind the kindred together. You could believe whatever else you thought must be true. Yet not since she was a maiden 1,400 years ago had Aliat felt such power as lingered here. Within her, if not in the altar or the air, hope, cleansing, purpose, something she could give instead of forever taking or squandering. Was that why Corinne had asked her to lead the consecration of this building? Or was Corinne simply too occupied with the question of who or what layered behind that innocent-seeming call to the long-lived? She had certainly gone close-mouthed. Aliat knew merely that she soon learned the Willock named was no more than an agent under the impression he was handling matters for a scientific outfit. Could that even be true? Maybe Corinne had asked those contacts of hers in the government, police, FBI, whoever and wherever they were, to look into the matter. No, probably not. Too dangerous.
It might alert them to the fact that Mama Lo Makandal was not all she seemed. Well, not to worry, she had said, and a hard life did teach a girl how to concentrate on what was close to hand. Aliat sighed, rose, blew out the candles, turned off the lights as she left. The chapel was on the second floor. Besides making it fit for use, workers had rebuilt the rotting staircase to the hallway outside it. But otherwise, so far, they were occupied elsewhere. A naked bulb glared on peeling, discolored plaster. This was a nasty district, way down on the Lower West Side. However, here the Unity could cheaply acquire an abandoned tenement house for its members to restore to decency. She couldn't help wondering whether there would ever be more such undertakings. Let it get bigger and it would become too noticeable, and beyond the control of that pair whose cover and stronghold it was. Nonetheless, people who belonged were bound to grow up, marry, have children. She descended to a jumble of equipment and materials in the lobby. The night watchman rose to greet her. Another man got up, too, young, big, ebony-hued. Aliat recognized Randolph Castle.
"Good evening, Mrs. Lo Rosa," he rumbled. "Peace and strength."
"Why, hello," she replied, surprised. "Peace and strength. What are you doing here so late?"
"Thought I'd walk you back. Figured you might stay on after the rest had left."
"That's very kind of you."
"Just being careful," he said grimly. "We don't want to lose you."
They bade the watchman good night and went out. The street was poorly lit, its murk apparently empty, but you never knew what might wait in those shadows, and taxis didn't cruise the area. Her place wasn't far, a light housekeeping room in the village. However, she was glad to have formidable company.
"Wanted to talk with you anyway," he said once they had started off, "if you don't mind."
"No, of course not. That's the main part of what I'm for, isn't it?" He must force the words out.
"No personal troubles this time. It's for everybody. Only I don't know as how we can tell Mama Lo."
Aliat brushed fingers across his clenched fist. "Go on," she urged gently. "Whatever you say will be safe with me."
"I know. Oh, I know."
She had heard his confession of wrongdoing and helped him set matters right. After a number of hollowly thudding footfalls,
"Look, Mama Lo don't realize how bad this area is. None of us did, or I guess we wouldn't have bought into it. But I've been finding out.
Crime, drug dealing, we've handled those before. What else?"
"Nothing. But these dealers, they're mean. They know about us, and they don't intend we should get no foothold here, no ways."
Chills struck through her. She had met absolute evil in century after century and knew its power. Once she had laughed this presence of it off. "Who cares as long as we keep our own people clean," she said. "Let others wreck themselves if they want. You smuggled in booze and ran speakeasies during Prohibition. I did pretty much the same. What's the difference?" "I'm surprised you don't know better than to ask that," Corinne answered. She paused. "Well, you've been trying hard to steer clear of everything wicked. Listen, dear, the stuff that's coming in these days is different. We say nothing in the Unity against taking an occasional drink. We use wine in some of our ceremonies, but we teach our members not to get drunk. You cannot not lose your mind to stuff like crack. And the old gangsters could get vicious enough. I'm not sure now that I should ever have condoned their business, but compared to the dealers today, they were the holy innocents." Her fingers writhed together. "Today it's like the slave trade come back." That was years ago, when things were only starting to get bad. Aliat had learned since then, and the Unity took action at each of its settlements. A solid band of dwellers who kept watch, called the police whenever they had information, set an example, helped the lost find the way home to humanness, and stood together in half-military wise. They could make a neighborhood unprofitable, actually dangerous, for pushers.
"I've been threatened myself," Castle said. "Other guys have, too. I think, we really think, if we don't pull out,
The mob's going to try and blow us away.
We can't abandon the project, she told him. We've sunk more than we can afford to lose into it. The Unity isn't rich, you know.
Yeah, I know. So what can we do?
He straightened.
Fight back. That's what we can do.
People aren't allowed to defend themselves in New York City, she snapped.
Uh-huh. Only, well, sure, we can't tell Mama Lo. We can't let her know.
She'd have to forbid, wouldn't she? No matter what we'd lose.
But if some of us was ready to fight back, and word of that got around underground, why, maybe we'll never have to. How about that? You've been around a lot. What do you think?
I'll need to hear a great deal more, and yes, think hard. Already Aniyat suspected what her decision would be.
Sure. We'll talk whenever you can spare the time, Mrs. Low Rosa. We're dependent on you.
On me, she thought, and pride thrilled. They walked mute thereafter to the entrance of her home building. She gave him her hand.
Thanks for being so honest, Randy, she said. Thank you, Mrs. Low.
In this brighter illumination, his smile gleamed.
When can we meet again?
Temptation blazed. Why not at once? He was strong and handsome in his rugged fashion, and it had been a long time, and she wondered if she had at last become able to give of herself wholeheartedly, without hate or contempt, or even suspicion. But no, he might be shocked. Certainly many members would be if they found out. Better not chance it. Soon, she promised. Right now I have some record-keeping chores to finish. In fact, I'd better put in a couple of hours tonight before I go to sleep. Soon, though.
6.
From the lounge where he sat, turning over the pages of a British magazine without the text especially registering on his mind, Hanno could see into the foyer. Twice a woman entered, and his heart jumped. But she went on toward the elevator. The third time proved the charm. She spoke with the clerk at the desk, turned, and moved hesitantly his way. At once he rose from the leather of the armchair. It crossed his mind that long residence in this country might not have given a Russian Western habits of punctuality, and a Russian perhaps hundreds of years old. She came in and halted. His vision flashed across her. Becker's description was sketchy, and the German had been under orders not to ask for photographs, lest a prospect take alarm. She was about as tall as Hanno, which put her on the short side among modern Nordics, though average among her own kind. A full figure, lithely and erectly born, gave the impression of more height. Her features were broad, blunt, comely. Blonde hair and a Dutch bob framed fair skin. Quietly dressed, she wore low shoes and carried a shoulder bag. Her brows lifted, tongue-touched lips. If she was nervous, which would be more than understandable, she mastered it gamely. Mr. Caldwell? How could that husky voice sound familiar? Just déjà vu, no doubt. Hanno bowed.
At your service, Dr. Rasmussen, he said. Thank you for coming.
She constructed a smile for him. Miss Rasmussen will do, if you please. You will remember I am a veterinarian, not a physician. Her English came readily, though the heavy accent was more Slavic than Danish. I am sorry to be late. It is because of an emergency in my office.
That's okay. You couldn't leave an animal to suffer.
He recalled how much they made of shaking hands here, and extended his.
I am glad you could, and would, come at all.
Her grip was firm. The blue gaze intensified upon him, no longer shy. Not forward, either. Watchful. He thought of a hunter. Yes, but it was also puzzled, more than this curious meeting warranted.
Your agent made it sound interesting, she said. I can promise nothing until I have heard more.
Of course. We need to talk quite a lot, and then, if I am not presuming, I would like the pleasure of your company at dinner. Win or lose, he would. Why did she excite him so?
The talk should be private.
This hotel doesn't have a bar, but we can find one close by, or a coffee shop, or anything you wish, as long as we won't be distracted or overheard. She went straighter to business than he had dared hope. I think you are a gentleman, Mr. Caldwell. Let us use your room.
Wonderful.
Old Manners returned, and he offered her his arm. She took it with a natural grace, making up for the fact that she had obviously not had much practice. They were silent in the elevator, never quite looking at each other.
Damn, he thought, something about her haunts me. Could I have seen her before? Hardly possible. Oh, I have visited Denmark now and then, but while she's sightly, she wouldn't stand out in a crowd of such women as they've got here.
He had taken a top-floor suite. The hotel was fairly old, far from Copenhagen's loftiest, but these windows gave a view of a bustling downtown and lovely soaring spires. Furnishings were comfortable, a little faded, reminiscent of a gentility well-nigh vanished from the world. She smiled more easily than at first.
"You have good taste in places to stay," she murmured. "This is a favorite of mine," he said. "Has been for a long time."
"Do you travel much?"
"Going to and fro in the earth and walking up and down in it. Please be seated. What would you like to drink? I have a small refrigerator. Beer, aquavit, scotch, soda. Or I'll be glad to send down for anything else."
"Coffee, thank you." A cautious choice. He rang. Turning around, he saw that she hadn't taken cigarettes from her bag. Probably then, unlike most Danes, she didn't smoke. He wished for his pipe to soothe him, but decided against it, and settled facing her.
"I am not sure how much Becker made clear to you," he began.
"Very little. I am frank about that. He told of the Rufus Institute in America, and how it wanted to study persons who can expect to live for many years. The interest in history, there are more measures of intelligence than that. I went away feeling very unsure. When you telephoned from across the ocean, I wondered whether to make this appointment. But I will hear you, Mr. Caldwell. I am the man who founded the Institute." She studied him.
"You must be rich."
He nodded.
"Yes."
Himself alert for any clue whatsoever.
"I am a great deal older than I look."
Did the breath hiss inward between her teeth?
"To me you seem young, as you do to me. May I ask your age?"
"I told Mr. Becker."
Starkness stood forth.
"No doubt he or you or a detective of yours checked the public records." He lifted a palm.
"Hold on, please. We both need to be honest, but let's not push ahead too hard. Allow me a few questions. You are Russian by birth?"
"Ukrainian. I reached Denmark in 1950. By now I am naturalized." He made his lips shape a soundless whistle.
"Almost 40 years ago. And you must have been adult then."
Her grin was taut. "You are searching for people who age slowly, no?
How old are you, Mr. Caldwell?"
"I wonder if we shouldn't postpone that subject a while," he said carefully. "Perhaps we should." Both of them shivered.
"I don't want to pry," he said, "but I had better know. Are you married?"
"I am not currently." The flaxen head shook.
"Nor I. I have not married in this country. I got permission to change my last name. Olga is common enough in Denmark, but the rest of it nobody could spell or pronounce.
And Rasmussen here is like Smith in the USA. You didn't want to be more conspicuous than you could help, did you?"
"Not at first. Things have changed since."
She sighed. "I have wondered lately if I might even go back, now when they say the terror has been ended. Never a day but I have longed for my motherland."
"You could have too much explaining to do."
"Probably. I did go away as a refugee, an outlaw." "That was not precisely what I meant," he thought, "and I suspect she realizes it."
"The Danish government knows, down in its archives," she proceeded. "I said little to Mr. Becker, but you may as well hear. During the war I was a soldier in the Red Army. Many Ukrainians wanted to be free, of Stalin or of the Soviet Union itself, because we are the old, true Russians. Kiev was the seed and the root of the whole Russian nation. The Moskale came later. Many of us welcomed the Germans for liberators. That was a terrible mistake, but how could anybody know when for more than 20 years all we heard was lies or silence? Some men enlisted with Hitler. I never did, I tell you. One resists the invader, whoever he is. But when the Germans retreated, they left parts of the Ukraine in revolt. Stalin needed years to crush it. Have you heard this?" "I know something about it," he said bleakly. "If I remember aright, the resistance movement had a headquarters in Copenhagen. Just the same, hardly a word about what was happening got into the liberal... No, in Europe, liberal retained its original meaning, the Western establishment press. I had been discharged, but I had friends, kinsmen, people of mine in the rebellion. Some openly fought. Some were sympathizers who gave what help they could whenever they dared. I knew I was under suspicion. If I did not soon betray somebody to Stalin's secret police, they would come for me. Then it would be the labor camp, or the bullet in the head, or worse." Anguish reawakened. "But how could I join the rebels? How could I shoot at Russian soldiers, my comrades of the war? I fled. I made my way to the West." "That was an awesome doing," he said, altogether sincerely. "It had meant hunger, thirst, hiding, running, walking, slipping past guard posts, surviving on what scraps of food she chanced to find, for 1,000 miles and more." "I am strong," she replied. "I had my sharpshooter skills, and I had prepared myself." Fingers gripped the arms of her chair. "It was not my first time like that." Thunder racketed in his skull. "I have had adventures of my own in the past." A knock sounded. Hanno got up and admitted a bellboy who brought a tray with urn, cups, sugar, cream, and kringler. While he oversaw its placement and tipped the man, he said, because lightness was necessary but stillness impossible, "You've had a peaceful time since, I gather." He felt the same need was driving her. "I got asylum in Denmark." From what officials and how, he wondered. Not that it mattered. If you knocked around in the world long enough, you learned the ways of it, and the byways. "I wanted that because of the Ukrainian connection. But I came to love this country. They are dear people, and the land is so mild. I worked on a farm, decided I would like to be a veterinarian, went to school, studied English and German also, to talk with foreigners who might bring me their pets. Now I have a practice out in Kongens-Lyngby, a nice suburb." The bellman had left. Hanno walked back to stand above her. "But you are of retirement age, or nearly," he said. "Your friends marvel at how you still appear young. They tease you about a fountain of youth. They begin to wonder, though, why you don't retire. The government does, too. Where will you go, Olga?" She gazed steadily up at him. "Yes, they keep excellent records in Denmark. Where would you suggest that I go? And what is your real name?" His pulse hammered. "All right," he said. "No more pussyfooting. I didn't want to scare you off. However, I believe I can come right out with the truth after all." He resumed his chair, not to seem threatening or attempting of dominance. One like her would react fiercely to that, he judged. "What I am about to tell you will sound like insanity, or some wild confidence game, unless you are what I'm pretty sure you are. Do not take fright. Listen to me. Go open the door and stand by it if you wish." She shook her head. Her breasts rose and fell. "As close as makes no difference," Hanno said. "I am 3,000 years old. You care to tell me—" "What?"
She had gone wholly white. For a moment she sagged back in her chair. He half rose to help and reassure. She straightened.
"Kadog," she whispered.
"Huh?"
"Kadog.
You. It comes back to me. The traitor in Kiev. Kiev, we called it then. When was that? Nearly 1,000 years past, I think." Memory smote like a sudden look into the sun.
"You.
Your name."
"I was Svoboda then.
In my heart I always am. But who are you, really?" Of course, he thought in his days, neither would remember a briefly met mortal for very long, out of an uncountable myriad gone down into dust. But neither had ever quite forgotten, either. He called to mind now the phantom that had stirred in him at moments strewn through the centuries.
"Svoboda."
"Yes," he stammered. "We rescued you. And the night was golden. We could have had more." They left their chairs and stumbled into each other's arms. 7. Outside, the District of Columbia stewed in its summer. Air conditioning breathed coolness through Moriarty's office. The heat that he felt was dry, a fire. He slapped the magazine down onto his desk. The noise cracked. "You bastard," he mumbled. "You evil malignant." The intercom chimed. "Mr. Stoddard to see you, Senator," announced his receptionist's voice. Moriarty caught a breath and gusted it back as a laugh. "Perfect timing," he exclaimed. "Send him right in." The man who entered was short, undistinguished-looking, and coldly competent. Sweat from outdoors glistened on his cheeks. He carried a briefcase. "How do you do, sir?" he greeted. His glance went from face to desk and back again. "You've been reading the latest, I see." "Of course," Moriarty snapped. "Sit down. Have you seen it?"
"Not yet."
Stoddard took a chair. "I've been busy investigating the person responsible, you know." The fleshy man behind the desk picked up the magazine again and placed it under his dashingly styled reading glasses. "Listen to this. The editorial deals with my speech in aid of the SS Air. I'm taking a paragraph at random, more or less." Trained, his voice shed the throb of indignation and recited methodically. "The senator was introduced by peace and disarmament activist Dr. Fulvia Born. He dealt with the embarrassment in masterly fashion. Rather than refer to her speech at the previous day's banquet, whether to endorse or disavow such colorful phrases as the Pentagon, a pentacle crowded with the demons of nuclear madness, or the CIA, the Children Immolation Agency, he made an unspeech of it and simply called her a modern Joan of Arc. That Saint Joan took arms in the cause of liberation became an unfact. Thence it was an easy transition to the necessity for statesmanship, for patience abroad but impatience at home. Evidently the patience is to be with the likes of Señors Castro and Ortega. After all, the senator's esteemed party colleague, the Reverend Nahaliel Young, addresses both these gentlemen as dear comrade. We are to have no patience whatsoever with, say, South Africa. As for domestic policy, an impatience to complete the destruction of the productive classes in America."
"Arr!"
erupted. "Why go on? Read it for yourself, if you can stand to."
"May I ask a question, Senator?" Stoddard murmured.
"Certainly. I've always stood for free and open dialectic."
Stoddard's gaze weighed Moriarty.
"Why do you let this Tannehill get your goat? He isn't writing anything that other opponents of yours don't."
The broad countenance reddened.
"He puts no bounds on his nastiness. Opposition is different from persecution. You know how he tries not just to make trouble nationally, but to drive a wedge between me and my constituency."
"Oh, he does operate out of New England and make a lot of regional references, but he's not in your state, Senator, and really, the chart room has a small circulation.
It only takes a small dose of virus slipped to the right people to infect a whole population. Tannehill's getting attention not just from old-line conservatives and neo-fascists,
but on campuses among the young.
Moriarty sighed. Oh, yes, the snake has his First Amendment rights, and I admit his jibes at me hurt more than they ought. I should be used to cruelty.
If I may say so, you often leave yourself open to the likes of him. I'd have advised you against addressing that rally.
In politics, you take what allies you can find and make the best of them.
Like South Africa?
Sorry.
Stoddard didn't sound repentant. Moriarty frowned, but continued.
The committee does include some extremists, but damn it, they're extremists in a good cause. We need their energy and dedication.
He cleared his throat. Never mind. Let's get to business. The business of discovering who this Tannehill is and who's behind him. What can you tell me?
Nothing much, I'm afraid, as far as my investigators have dug, and they're good at their work.
He's clean.
True, they didn't manage to dig to the very bottom.
Oh?
Moriarty leaned forward. He remains the mystery man on that estate of his.
The remark was irresistible.
He would have settled in New Hampshire, wouldn't he? Live free or die. He may even believe it.
He's not a Howard Hughes-like recluse, if that's what you mean, Senator, Stoddard replied. In fact, what makes him hard to learn about is that he's seldom at his place. He gets around, everywhere, maybe. Though, for the most part, my men couldn't find out where he does go. Neither his household servants nor his magazine staff were any help to speak of. There are two handfuls of hand-picked individuals, long with him, loyal to him, close-mouthed. Not that they keep any shameful secrets. He chuckled. No such luck. They simply don't know what the boss does away from them, and they have an antiquated Yankee notion that it's nobody's business.
Moriarty gave his assistant a sharp glance. Sometimes he wondered whether Stoddard was not aiding him strictly for the pay. However, the fellow performed well enough that one must put up with his occasional impudence.
"What have you found?" Moriarty asked. "No matter if you repeat things I already know."
End of side 10. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.